Australian True Crime. The live show is coming.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast is recorded. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and to Aboriginal elders emerging. Hello, friends. Patreon.com/osttruecrimepod. In case you don't know, that's how you can get your name read out on the front bit here. But that's not all you get. You get an extra episode every month, at least an extra episode. We've dropped a few bits and pieces this last week, actually, because I had a few things up my sleeve. And also, we get to have conversations very much more easily with our patrons. At the moment, I'm asking a question, which is how many of our patrons are aspiring podcasters or true crime writers? Would there be any value in offering some kind of, mentorship or something like that through Patreon? So that's the question I'm asking at the moment. Okay, on with the show.
We went to have our last dinner all together because we were about to fly out, and we're sitting there having, they had like peanut butter on toast and stuff, really Australian stuff. And next minute we were surrounded by military police with their big guns drawn. So they marched us all to the police station and separated us. I got told, you're going to the airport to fly back to Australia, but we're keeping the two men. So I never saw them. That was it.
One of our favourite things is being contacted by listeners of Australian True Crime who tell us that they have true crime stories of their own. And today's guest, Julie, is one such person. Julie brings us a story from 1970s suburban Australia. I guarantee you'll find yourself thinking at some stage, if not repeatedly, this should be a movie. It's got so much nostalgic charm, it's got romance, it's got adventure, and it's got a wonderful surprise twist at the end, which I definitely did not see coming. I can almost guarantee that after listening to this episode, Julie will be the loveliest convicted international drug trafficker you have ever known. She's definitely top three for me.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb.
We started this conversation by asking Julie to describe herself to us as she was when she was a teenager, when her criminal career began.
I was a very sweet, innocent young girl. Never been in trouble, never wagged school, just a very suburban young girl.
Still at school because without, I was going to say without giving your age away, but the story will give your age away. But I'm going to say you're roughly, I think, probably about the age of my mum.
66.
Okay, yes. Yep. And certainly my mum left school when she was about 15 and she was working.
Yeah. I left when I was 13, hated school, absolutely hated it. So I had to get permission off the education department to leave at 13. I then went to a business college for a year and learned how to type and shorthand and do all that sort of stuff, and then went out to the world. So I was probably 14, 15.
Was this your first travelling experience?
It was. I had never left Australia. Yes.
When in 1970, this fateful conversation you and some friends had, sitting around just chatting about the price of marijuana, as you do.
As you do.
Tell us what happened during that conversation. Who was there? Where were you?
Oh, look, there would have been myself, my boyfriend, a couple of other mates who it was a house that we lived in Moonee Ponds. And we were just discussing and someone said, oh, we'll just get a boat and sail over somewhere and buy heaps of marijuana and sail it back. That sounded really easy.
Sounds like a teenage dream. Yes. Because why was marijuana expensive?
Back compared to now, no. But back then, for us who probably weren't all working at that stage. Mm.
You thought it was too much?
I just thought it was a really good idea.
This is bullshit, paying all this for our marijuana. Get a boat.
Yeah, but then we realised we'd have to know how to navigate a boat.
And buy a boat, I guess.
So that sort of became, not good. So there was a couple of other people that were on the, friends who were on the peripheral and weren't smokers. And I don't really recall how, because we sort of tried to keep it pretty close. And one of the guys on the peripheral who wouldn't even come into the house because we were smoking. He said, oh, no, I'm not going in there.
Straighty.
So I thought everyone smoked back then.
Yeah. Also, he was a real ladies' man, fast cars. And one day at the front door, because that's as close as he would come, he said, oh, look, I know a pilot. Would that be any use? And we sort of went, oh, that might be a bit easier. So we discussed it and he said he's like my uncle. So off he went. He supposedly worked with him. He said, this guy. Yep. Approached him and he's willing to do. So we came up with a plan that he would be the pilot. We would hire a small plane, fly over to Sumatra and buy a whole lot of marijuana and stick it in the plane and fly home.
From Melbourne?
From Melbourne, yes.
I mean, that's not...
They were going to Island Hop. So,
but I mean, you've got to get over this really big island first.
That was all just little,
It's like 7 hours. Anyone who's been to Bali knows that if in a Qantas plane, it's 7 hours to get over just Australia.
So I think they were going to go from Melbourne to Timor because then they didn't have all the stuff that they've got now, like radar and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
So you could fly into a lot of these little islands without being detected.
Right.
That was the theory anyway.
Yeah.
And then from Timor to Bali.
Right.
And then from Bali to Medan and then Medan up to Sumatra.
For a bunch of teenage potheads who'd never travelled, you were pretty cluey.
Yeah, so none of us had ever been outside Australia. We were all just surfy crew from down the coast. And
so who knew all this stuff? Who's plotting the course and was it the uncle or?
No, so probably the main guys. I was just, I happened to be there because I was one of the fella's girlfriends. So I don't really recall how I actually, got in there, but I
was there. You were too stoned, let's be honest. Yep.
Exactly. Yes. Good point.
Jesus, Julie.
I sort of feel like back then, as you said, they didn't have all the kind of detection things.
No.
Like it's quite plausible that you could do that because remember there was that Mr. Asia drug syndicate.
Yes.
Those Buddha sticks and stuff and that's how they were making heaps of cash.
And we also had a friend, a young lady, who had travelled the world and every time she came back, she either came back pregnant and it was strapped to her belly or she came back as a young schoolgirl because she was really sweet and innocent and she was on her body was just taped. Just everywhere. It was always smoke. It was never powder. So it was probably through her information that we thought, if she can do this.
Yeah.
So that's where we got our contact in Sumatra off her. That's how we knew where to go.
Okay. And she was just coming through commercial airports.
Yep.
So you were
just
gonna
rocking on through, which was really easy back then.
Were you aware of the heavy penalties in Asia?
No. No, because we're talking Bali here. No, we weren't. No, we're oblivious, totally oblivious. Well, I was anyway. I think it even got discussed.
And again, this is the kind of idea that teenagers have. Did you really think it was going to happen from the beginning? Did you?
Yep.
Really?
So I was very sweet, young and naive.
Yeah, and you really thought, yep, yeah, we're really honestly going to do this.
And
yeah.
This was going to be stuff for all of you just to smoke. It wasn't going to be like to sell.
Oh, well, there was a lot of it. So, you know, that was probably an idea as well because there was a ton.
A ton.
A literal ton or you?
Yep.
Oh. A literal ton.
Yep, bought a ton.
What happened then? When did it actually?
So the friend went to this pilot who turned out to be not like an uncle at all, but we all obviously found this out later. And this bloke's gone, yeah, I can do that. Obviously, we're going to pay him because he's going to be doing something illegal.
What do you mean by not like an uncle at all?
He was sort of like a work colleague, but very loosely like a work colleague. So this guy was a panel beater and this guy used to bring his trucks in to get panel beated and he noticed that he had wings on his lapel.
Right.
As in, because when you're a pilot, you've got flying time, you can get little wings.
So
apparently.
You're saying they didn't even know each other very well?
No.
Not only were they not related,
no.
They didn't even know each other very well.
So we found out this later. So he's got, oh, yeah, I can do that. So he came and had a meeting with us and we put the plan to him, a very basic. And he decided in his wisdom that, no, this was not a good idea, so he went straight to the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, which was what it was called back then.
No way!
Yep. Didn't even go to the police. He just went straight there. And they said, oh, great idea. You keep doing what you're doing. And they wanted us to get over there, buy it, bring it back. And bust us because we'd probably still be locked up.
It's a bit like the Bali.
The Bali Nine. They still do this.
The uncle went to the feds to try and get them to stop it and they let him go.
Yep. Yes. Oh, God.
If it was in America, it'd be entrapment.
Yes.
Because you can't help people commit crimes and not get into trouble. But that's what they did. So we wouldn't have got out the country. We wouldn't have got our passports. We wouldn't have got our visas. So this was all. They were two steps in front of us, so they put the whole thing in because we're oblivious. We didn't know how to get passports or visas or I can't even remember going to buy the airline tickets and we bought them off of a federal narcotics bloke sitting behind the desk. So it all came, you know, when you finally thought about it, that's what that bloke was and that's what that person was.
Oh, no.
So they just fed us all the way and spent lots of money. Too, mind you, to do all this.
How old were you?
19 by then.
19.
So I turned 20 and then I turned 21 when I was in Winlayton.
And this is in Winlayton Girls Home. Oh, God.
Which only goes from 14 to 18. So
the problem with this whole thing that we learnt through the Bali Nine is doing what you think is the right thing in Scott Rush's dad's case of trying to stop your son committing a crime and going to the authorities here in Australia is that potentially you can get done in Indonesia where the penalties are so much worse and can be death.
Yep, because they were supposed to let them come home as well.
Yes.
And that's what they were supposed to do to us, but they went, oh, no, we're going to step in here because we want some of this limelight.
Right.
That's exactly.
So you got all the way to, did you get all the way to Sumatra?
Yeah. Tom and I, we went. And
did you get the gear?
Yep, went up in the mountains and bought it off this farmer and he came over the mountains on donkey backs in big sacks. And
what was it like going up the mountain? Like, what was it like? You've never been out of Australia.
That was pretty eye-opening. That was amazing because it's the most beautiful country, Sumatra. But we had Interpol police. We had Interpol travel. Like, they were literally two steps behind us.
Yeah, so but at this stage, it's still the best holiday of your life. I mean, at this stage, you're still a 19-year-old from Coburg who's never been out of Australia. It must have been amazing.
Yep. So it was only supposed to be 2 weeks, and so my parents didn't know I'd even left the country, obviously, let alone all the other fellas' parents. So 2 weeks came up, and I thought, oh, they're going to start wondering where I am because I was really close to my parents. And then it turned out that the pilot couldn't fly very much, so he only had a certain amount of hours up, so he could only fly a certain distance. So the federal narcs went, oh, God. So then they had to find another pilot, which none of us knew, and had to introduce him to the blokes back here. So it's sort of starting to get a bit, you know, what's going on.
So they had to introduce him to the whole story.
Yes.
This whole...
And he's just a normal... I don't even know where they got him from, but he was just a normal person. I don't know.
Did you know how he got introduced into the circle, like into the group?
No, because I was still in Sumatra.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, So he's done... And then I said, look, I've got to go back home because everyone's going to start going, oh, I wonder where I am. So the plane never made it up to Sumatra. It just stayed on the tarmac at Bali because the Indonesian cops went, this ain't happening. So by the time... So I went back to Bali. Two of my partner stayed up there with the hooter, and then the other guy flew up to meet him. I think we met in Medan, and we were in this huge ultra-modern motel that we were the only people in. There was no one else there. He's going, gee, it's really empty. Duh. So they emptied it so we would just have total control. So they used to have little holes through the walls, so they took photos of us and stuff.
Did they really?
I found out this later. They needed to monitor.
But you had the pool to yourself, so.
Yeah, it's all right.
And then I made it back to Bali, even got befriended by a couple of blokes who I thought were fellow travellers and thought, oh, they took me out for dinner. Well, they turned out to be narcotics agents as well. As I said, I was very naive. And then Bali... It was just Kuta. That was like one stretch of a few cafes in, and the Bali Beach Hotel, which was the only big motel. That's where the two pilots were staying. So I went there, stayed with them for a night. I'm not sure why I did that. The other two made it down from Sumatra to Bali with the hooter. I don't even recall how they did that because it wasn't obviously on the plane because the plane was still on the tarmac. So yeah. Don't know, don't remember. But by the time we got busted in Bali, there wasn't a ton anymore. The Indonesian police had said, well, we'll just, because they were obviously very corrupt back in those days, we'll just have most of this and you can have this little bit.
Yeah. Do you remember the raid? Do you remember the moment?
Yeah, we were sitting, my partner and I were ready to fly home, so we were just coming home on a commercial flight. The hooter was in Bali and that was going to get loaded on the plane. The two pilots still stayed at the Bali Beach, I think it was called. And then we went and checked into a little Losman, just a local little, you know, bungalows. And we went to have our last dinner all together because we were about to fly out. And we're sitting there having, they had like peanut butter on toast and stuff, really Australian stuff. And we invited a young bloke from the Losman just to come and have dinner with us. And we're all sitting there. Next minute we were surrounded by military police with their big guns drawn. Mm. And we sort of go, oh, my God, I think we're in trouble. Still quite oblivious that why we were getting – we just assumed it was because we had a bit of smoke back at the Losman and they marched us back there and found it. We just sort of put us, you know, that's all we've got because that was all that we did have right there. So they marched us all to the police station and separated us, obviously. And I got told, you're going to the airport to fly back to Australia. And I went, I got out of that one easy, didn't I? But we're keeping the two men. They let the other guy. They realised that he wasn't part of it. So I never saw him. That was it. Okay. Still thinking that it was only for the little bit of smoke that we had. I got to the airport, ready to, you know, checked in. Then I realised I had my partner's passport and all the travellers, because it was travellers' checks back in those days. And I just went, oh. So on the way to the airport with the police person, because we were out in the middle of, God, I didn't know where I was, he stopped the car and pulled over and started to trying to pash on to me.
Oh, no.
And I've got, oh, what's this man going to do? So opened the door and I was just going to go for it. And he said, you must tell me what's going on and why are you doing this? And so I assumed the Australian government weren't and police weren't telling them what they wanted to know. And he stopped and dropped me at the airport. So I had a big meltdown because I still had my partner's passport. So I went up to the check-in desk and it was narcotics agents And I said, oh, I've got Tom's pass, and he's just been locked up and blah, blah, blah. Oh, I will make sure he gets it. And I jumped on the plane. So I sort of go,
oh, God, how frightening. Quick,
didn't it? Really
totally freaked.
All of it.
The plane was quite empty, so I was surrounded by narcotics agents. They didn't, they thought, I don't know what they thought I was going to do, like jump out the plane or whatever. So I was still oblivious. I thought, oh, you know, it must be just because of the smoke. So they're keeping the two boys and got back to Australia, went all the way through customs, just about to walk out that last door. And I got a little tap on the shoulder and he said, oh, da-da-da-da, would you like to come with me? And I said, oh, no, I'm right. Thank you.
I'm okay, thanks.
Oh, I've got a couple of friends meeting me out the front. And he went, oh, don't worry about them, we've got them. Oh. Then the penny dropped.
Oh.
And I went, oh, my God, I think I'm in big trouble. So we got taken back to the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, which was in Flinders Street, right in the city back then. And there was the other couple, there was three of them. And we all sort of looked at each other and went, I think we're in trouble. But we still sort of didn't really know what was going on because they weren't telling us anything. And they were asking me a lot of questions because I was the one over. And I'm just playing. Well, I was pretty dumb, so I was playing dumb. And then after a few hours, they said, right, you're all going to be charged with, because there was no hooch, there was no marijuana, they had to figure out what to charge us with. So they obviously had their lawyer and they said, well, the only thing they could charge us with was conspiracy to import a prohibited substance, which they did, which was the first case in Australia that had ever happened.
Was it?
Yeah, which I was quite amazed at that.
Yeah. Where was the gear? Where was the marijuana?
Well, I think there was still some in Sumatra because they couldn't get it all down to Bali, and there was some on the plane on the tarmac. But that's when the Indonesian cops stepped in and went, no, you Australian, you aren't flying that back to Australia, because they really wanted to get it back to Australia.
And then there was the amount that had been skimmed.
And then when the two blokes in Bali went to court, there was, I think my partner said there was about 4 kilos by the time I went to court.
Wow. Oh, wow.
So a lot had gone and missed, which was lucky for them because that's what they got charged with, but they got screwed over there badly.
But so you couldn't be done for any of it? Is that, did you could only be done for conspiracy?
Yeah, yeah. And I always said, you know, why did you send me home? They said, because the Indonesian government decided when they stepped in, they didn't want to know about a young woman locking her up in an Indonesian jail, thank God.
I always think of Nicole Kidman in Bangkok Hilton. It's like my yardstick of terror.
Well, oh, yeah, think of Chappelle Corby in Kiribati jail.
Yeah, yeah, I would have come out a very, very different person.
What happened to the two guys? Who one of them was your boyfriend?
Yep, they got 5 years.
Okay.
And probably did about 4.5, 5 years. They're both passed now, which is quite. They both passed of a very rare leukemia. They both had the same leukemia, which was it's quite bizarre.
Yeah. Do you think they got it over there?
Well, who knows? I don't know.
How long did they have to wait for their case to even go to court in Indonesia?
Oh, probably over a year. Yeah, so quite a long time. We got processed really, really quickly because it was all political.
Mm.
It was when...
There were some big headlines when I was looking up the newspaper archive.
The Federal Bureau was under heaps of pressure to make lots of busts and nothing was happening, so they rubbed their little hands together. Right.
But meanwhile in Indonesia, so Kiribati hadn't been built yet, they were in
I don't think so, no, they definitely weren't there.
They were in a different facility. Yeah. For a year before they even went to trial. Mm. Were you able to stay in touch with them or did you?
No letters, no nothing. It wasn't till, oh, actually my partner did start writing after, you know, probably a year or so, but they just vanished. So then I also had to go and tell his parents that their son wasn't coming home for a little while.
Would they have been, they would have been one of the earliest cases of Australians in an Asian,
I'd say so.
Asian prison?
So that went, it was obviously before Facebook and social media, but Bali was becoming very popular.
Yeah.
And there must have been, in a lot of the Losmans, there must have been notice boards and people put notices up, go and visit these two blokes, these two Aussies. So they got a huge amount of visitors needs to take them in, because you could take your own food and you take your own drugs as long as you could survive. They had money.
Yep.
They didn't care. So they were relatively lucky because they could have been there, you know, a lot longer.
Yeah.
Were their parents able to go and visit them, or did they?
No, their parents, basically, they wiped them.
Oh, no, really?
So I went to the Australian Embassy here also and said, there's two Australians. So they just, everyone pretended it wasn't happening because the Australian government had stepped in and said, listen, you know, the embassy's not getting involved. So it was actually the British Embassy in Bali who looked after them. Not the Australian Embassy. They wouldn't even go and visit them.
When they came home, did they renew ties with their family?
Yes. Well, sort of, yeah. But they both came back very, very different men.
Did they?
Yep.
In what way? Like health-wise, obviously?
Health-wise, mental-wise, and they both got really bad drug addictions over there.
Oh.
Super bad.
So worse than the smoke.
Yep. And they were both very, very long-term users.
After the break, I'm sure you'll be shocked to learn that Australia's news media exaggerated a little when they reported on Julia's case.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Coming up on Australian True Crime, the amazing twist in Julie's story. I wonder if you figured out what it might be yet. But first, to Julie's experience as a newly minted criminal.
So I got sent, because all the boys were together in a watch house in Russell Street, and I got locked up in this, like it was just okay. It was like, you know, stepping back in time. We were all delegated to narcotics agents that sort of worked. You know, you had nice one and the not nice one.
Good cop, bad cop.
And the nice cop was going, you've got to ring up your mum and dad and tell them. And I'm going, you've got to be joking. Hello, mum, I've just been busted and I'm in jail. Don't think so.
For drug importation.
And the bad cop, funny, he got busted for importing marijuana many years later.
Oh, my gosh.
And he wrote a book called The Brown Tapes.
No.
Yes. Oh. So
he was a bad cop.
He was. So we all got charged with the same, and this is sort of where they bought themselves undone. So then they've got to set bail, and they decide – so I don't know who decides how much. So they set it at $3,000 each, which was a lot of goddamn money back then.
Your parents wouldn't have been able to come up with that.
No. Well, they didn't even know I was in jail at this stage. So I'm over there in the women's bit with this terrible prison guard woman who was – anyway, I could hear the mother of one of the guys, and I knew it was this particular woman – and I said, oh, can I go and talk to her? And first she wouldn't let me, and then she said, oh, okay. And I just said to the mother, can you, this is my mum and dad's phone number, can you, because the only people that knew I was locked up, they were locked up with me. And I thought, God, I'm going to be here forever. I'm never going to be found again. So she said, yep. So they sort of knew of each other but had never been introduced or anything. So this other mother rang up my mum and dad, and my mum answered the phone. So it was really, really late at night. And she said, your daughter's in the watch house. Oh. You've got to go and bail her out. So apparently my mother just hit the deck and my dad got on the phone and went, oh, who's this? And she's in the watch house. So he was there like in a split second. I couldn't believe how quick it was. And he didn't have the money, obviously, so he rang his boss and his boss bailed me out.
Oh.
He'd been with his work for a really, really long time.
Good people.
Yes. And because I got bailed on $3,000, they tried to set the boys at $9,000 each. But because we're all on the same charges, they couldn't. So they all got out probably a couple of days later, because that was like, so there was three of them. So that was like, you know, $9,000 we had to find to get him out.
Can you imagine the embarrassment of your dad ringing his boss?
His boss.
What kind of business was it he worked at? Like,
he was a confectioner.
My daughter's in jail and I need $3,000. Bless him.
What was the trial like? Was there a lot of media there or yeah, like it was packed, huge.
Packed with barristers because it was the first conspiracy case. So my family and was there every day. Don't recall anyone else's family being. Oh, one of the other guys' family, yes, they were because they were all really close. But it was packed with barristers because they were really interested how this was all going to go down. How can the cops do what they're doing and these people are getting into trouble for it? And they're sort of like, I know we broke the law, but we broke the law in over there, not here.
Also, you hadn't broken the law before they started assisting you in breaking the law.
If they hadn't assisted us, we would not have left the country because we didn't have the money and we didn't know how to do so much. And they just said, well, you just go there and tell them that, yes, you can do this. And they can, yeah, no, we'll do all this. And
so, as you said, very political, trying to make a example or try and bolster the power of.
Yes. We got busted on the Saturday morning. And on the Sunday night news, up on the screen, you know, four or five young people busted importing and they showed this big stack of hash. Oh. I go, hang on, how can they do that?
That wasn't your hash.
No.
Yeah.
My solicitor went to the TV station, they denied it. They said, no, we didn't do that. So there's nothing that you can do.
So it sounds like just a very big operation to...
Screw us.
Screw you. And also to put young people off the idea of importing drugs, right? They must have thought it Definitely. Was an impending problem.
Just starting to, be, you know, Nimbin was happening and, yep.
Your bail was revoked during the trial.
Yes, so I got sent to Fairleigh.
You got sent to Fairleigh Women's Prison, which is now Dame Phyllis Frost.
Oh, that was a bit horrific. So it got taken and I'm just going, I don't want to go. Please, I just don't want to go. So, you know, you go through the gates and you go and you've got a shower and there was these two girls sitting like, oh, we know who you are. Watch your back in here. Like they just tell you. And this, because this was on a Friday, so I was going to be there for the whole weekend. Got processed, you know, which takes hours and finally got put. So you were in wings. So you're in wings with other women. You weren't in actual cells. And luckily the wing they put me in, there was a young woman who had been following the case and she just came up and befriended me, which was really, really nice. So she's, that's just what happens in those places. So she befriended me and looked after me basically. But then later I found out she was the girlfriend of the notorious escapee that was locked in confinement. They didn't tell me that bit. So you just got locked up from, you know, probably 5 o'clock in the afternoon to 7 o'clock in the morning,
mm-hmm.
In the dorms, and then just let out. And I just remember being on kitchen duties.
So it wasn't as bad. It wasn't as bad as the anxiety that you had.
No, it wasn't. Yeah. No, I think because this girl decided she was going to, you know, be my buddy. Yeah. But I met the first woman murderer I'd ever met. She murdered her partner at the altar. He said, "I don't want to marry you." So she.
Oh, my God. You?
At the altar?
At the altar.
Well, no, apparently a bit later she went around and did him in. She was a bit...
Yeah.
They just said, just stay away from her. Mm-hmm. The first woman bank robber, she was a really nice lady. So there was... Look, I reckon there was probably only 15 women in there at the time. There wasn't many. Yeah, it wasn't big. But I remember my mum and dad coming to visit me and I go, oh, please get me out, please.
Yeah. And then so after a period of time, was it after your conviction that you ended up at Winlaton Girls?
Yeah, so when the judge handed down his sentence, we sort of pretty well knew by then that we're all going to get screwed. Well, I kept getting told that there is no way you will go to jail through the whole court case. They're going to screw the boys, but there's no way they'll screw you. And my barrister, because there was four of us and we all had individual barristers, my barrister said to me, look, there's no need for me to be there because there's these other three and you're all on the same charges. They'll look after you. So he went off and did this major bank robbery case in the courtroom next door. So he kept popping in and making sure.
He's getting paid for both, yeah, by the way.
Yes, right. Yes, of course.
Mm-hmm. He's like a tradie. He's got two jobs going at the same time. He's just popping in and out.
Yep. But he's got his bank robber off, mind you. Oh. And then, so when the judge was summing up, I think he gave the boys... Oh, one guy got off because he actually did have nothing to do with it. He just gave my partner and I the money to do it. So he got acquitted. The two boys and myself got... Well, I think they both got 5 years. And then it came to me and I thought... And he said, you're sentenced to 2 years, but in a youth training centre. And I thought, well, I wonder what that... I had no idea what that meant. He said Winlaton because it was only Winlaton then. And
that does sound pretty lucky, not having been to Winlaton myself, so that anyone who has been there is probably screaming at their whatever they're using right now, their phone or their car or whatever. But because I'm thinking you're 20 by now, are you?
Yes, yeah. I would have been.
So I'm thinking...
I was very lucky and I was over 18, so that was...
But I do know that Winlaton, for example, I know that it was named in the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse.
Oh, yeah, it was...
Okay, so I know it was no picnic.
No. So they had a remand bit, which was outside the fence. So they had a fenced area and there was all the dorms in there. Was three dorms. So one was for the sentenced chicks, as they called them. The next one was for the... They were all water state, so I didn't even know that exists. I didn't even know what a water state was back then.
Yeah.
So, you know, I just thought they were just naughty boys and girls. And then the other one was for really young chicks who were water states who had been sexually abused.
Mm. Poor little girls.
The remand centre, that was like a lockdown. And then Winlaton, the actual homestead, that was for when you're a good girl. After a certain amount of time in the walled area, you got put in there if you were still in. So I spent most of my time in the main house, which was nice.
Gosh, what did you do in there as a 20-year-old in the youth training centre?
So the first night I spent there and they all muck up because you're this older girl, and my mum came the next day. I said, oh, please send me back to Fairlie. can't cope because they're all really young. And
yeah.
I was probably there for about a week and I got called to the office. I thought, oh, God, here we go. The only person that had ever been there for marijuana, because it was all water state and all bank, a couple of chicks had done robberies and they were sentenced. And I said, you know, you're not to talk about any of what happened to the young, to the girls, because we, you know.
Don't give them ideas.
Don't give them ideas. And I'm like, oh, they're going to, you know, you're not allowed to say anything. That was with the head, I don't know what they were called. They weren't screws, but. The women who looked after you. And then I got called into the deputy superintendent's office and she said to me, look, I've been following your case. It turned out her husband was a top barrister and he'd been in the courtroom every day following it. And she said, I want you to come and work in my office and be my secretary.
Oh, and you had the skills. Oh,
that's like the top job to get if you're in a prison, isn't it?
Well, according to Orange is the New Black.
That's
right. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
That's what Tasty got.
Yeah, Tasty did get that one.
And then she took me in to see meet the superintendent, who was a bloke, and he was a really, really nice man. He used to be the superintendent at Malmesbury. And they said, look, you know, we're obviously putting a lot of trust in you because I had access to everyone's files. A lot of the staff weren't real pleased with this inmate. working in the office. So I had my own little desk and I wasn't interested in why other girls were in there, but obviously he got to read. Yeah. But it was obviously all very confidential. And after 3 months inside the locked bit, they sent me to the main house and I still went up and did the, so that was much. So you could literally walk out the front gate. So it was very open. So I got weekend leave after 6 weeks. So I could get out on the weekend and go and do whatever, which I did. Come back on Sunday.
I mean, you're an adult. It's so, yeah, it's such a yeah. weird scenario. You're yeah, an adult.
It was quite bizarre. So I got sentenced to 12 months. Oh, no, 2 years, but I did 12 months and then they paroled me for a year. Probably the last 3 months I was allowed to go out and get a job to go back into society, which I did.
Were you just living with your parents at that stage?
No, I went and lived with, yeah, I must have went home, but I don't think it was for very long. Mm. I think then I went and lived with the new fella.
How did you meet the new fella?
He was a friend beforehand, just in a big group, was starting to get on weekend leave. And I used to go to a girlfriend's place and he was always there.
Yeah.
So it just, you know, happened.
Happened. Life happens.
Yeah, life happens.
You went back to life and you had your daughter and...
Tom and I were writing.
Yeah.
Because right, back then you wrote letters.
Yeah. Did you reconnect?
Yes, yeah. We did. He was over there. I met the new fella, got with him, had a baby, and then my daughter was probably about 5 and we reconnected and we stayed together for probably 30, nearly 40 years.
With Tom?
We passed. Yeah.
With Tom.
Julie!
Oh, my God, Julie!
Yeah.
Oh, sweetheart.
So we both knew
I was thinking you wouldn't have seen each other again.
No, we reconnected. So the day he got back to Australia, he came to see me. And my daughter was literally just born, so he sort of stepped back because he knew that I was in this new relationship. But we both, it was unsaid, but we both knew one day we would be back together.
Oh, that's so beautiful. Yeah, I'm so glad.
We were just soulmates or what, you know, whatever you want to call us. But, yeah, no, we spent our rest of our life together. Well, the rest of his life together.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad.
Yeah.
Goodness.
And the other guy also reconnected with his lady.
Which was, for the rest of his life?
Yes. Yeah, but she died before he did, which was a shame. She had a heart attack suddenly.
When did Tom pass away?
2007. So it's a long ago now.
And he had leukemia, rare.
We didn't know about.
Yeah.
He was really sick and we didn't. Well, he was oblivious. Everyone was oblivious. We had a really bad bushfire in 2007. I was up at Myree, which is just around the corner from Moyhu, which is south of Wangaratta, and he literally collapsed. And I thought, good timing. Anyway, he got carted off and they said, oh, you know, he's pretty sick. They did a whole lot of tests. They found out he had a rare leukemia and he only had 3 months to live.
Jeez.
And he lasted 2.
Oh. Did you have kids with Tom?
No. Oh, yeah, we did, but she died. So we never went there again because it was very traumatic, as you would imagine.
Yeah, and you'd been through so much trauma.
Yeah, and he just said, I can't do that again. And we had my daughter from the other fella, and we brought her up, basically.
Yeah.
So we all live. So her dad, myself, my daughter, and Tom all lived together for many years.
You are not hippies, in a relationship. Yeah. You old hippies, you hippies. Never change. And I'm glad.
At the time, and she still speaks of it very fondly, that was a really, really good time in her life.
From what you've said about the way he came home, it can't have been easy. He must have had issues, PTSD
issues.
And lots of issues.
Yep.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, which you mention that a lot in your podcast, and I've always thought, I've never even thought of that.
Oh,
but both of those would have big time, which never obviously wouldn't have got dealt with.
No. But it was worth it, obviously.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we moved up the country, 2000. My daughter met her partner at uni. She went up there because he was from there, in Wangaratta, and we were her base while she was at uni, and we thought, well, now what do we do?
We'll all go up.
So we all, and even my dad went up too.
Oh, beautiful.
It's a beautiful part of the world.
Only surviving parent. Mm. So we took him up and bought a little house that I actually live in now.
It'd be peaceful.
Well, it is. It's lovely. You sort of lie there and you go, listen to that.
It's
people
gorgeous.
Go, what are you listening to? Oh, nothing.
Oh, you're talking me into it. Sounds
this is nice.
Has your experience, did it come up through the years? Did you ever get follow-ups from the media trying to find out what happened to this Julie?
No, other than the digger paper, which was the alternative paper back in the olden days, early 70s, they were the only ones interested. There was probably a few snippets in the Sun or the Herald back in those days.
Because I know there was, you know, cases, obviously, that people getting picked up for drug trafficking, but then there was the case with Charles Sobhraj, who was the serial killer in India, and there was an Australian nurse called Mary Ellen Ether, and she was Australian, and she got jailed, and she was sort of in his thrall, I suppose. There was a bit of publicity about her, but I don't know what's happened to Mary Ellen, but I always think of, you know, young women, Australian women getting caught up in these problems, and you...
And I don't think it got picked up on because I reckon the government and the Narcotics Bureau said, right, that's, you know...
It was a big story.
Yeah.
Back in the, yeah.
Oh, yeah,
it was a big story, but it seems to have been
very quiet.
Yeah, yeah, very closely...
Controlled.
Monitored, yeah. Yes, definitely. One of the other blokes that I'm still in contact... That's why I've got these notes, because I spoke to him, and so him and I are really, really, still really close, which is nice. The other guy, he's up north, but they both went to Beechworth Prison, and they, it was just okay. They had to, like, pee in buckets, and they didn't have a toilet in their cells or nothing.
Really?
Oh, yeah, it was just still.
I've stayed at Beechworth at the old lunatic asylum, like in the old nurses' quarters.
Yes.
It's actually incredible.
It's very weird, isn't it?
Yeah, it's weird, and you do ghost tours. It's really creepy.
That was in criminally sane people, so some of the stuff that went down there.
How long did they end up doing?
5 years.
They did their five?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, they didn't get paroled, so that was another government thing. So they were obviously a bit more lenient on me because I was a sweet, innocent young girl.
God, how times have changed, hey.
How did those guys go afterwards with life, you know, like
really
getting
good,
out?
Really good, actually, yeah. One married and he's gone up north to live and had kids. The other one works with street kids in Footscray.
Wow.
God, for a bunch of filthy hippies who tried to import drugs, you turned out to be really nice people who've contributed a lot to society,
exactly.
Haven't you?
Yeah. I've only told two people that I was coming, so because my daughter... Yesterday, we buried a very dear friend. I had a very dear friend who had a heart attack, and he came home to my place because he lives by himself so I could look after him, and he up and died on us a couple of weeks ago at my house. So it's been a really full couple of weeks. So she said, I'll come over today. And I said, I can't. I've got an appointment down in Melbourne. And she's going, oh, what? And I go, oh, I've got to, because everyone's always telling you, go on, you know, what is it? When you get dates. You know, and you'd swipe left.
Oh,
and
Tinder.
Thank you. See, I'm hopeless.
Yeah, I know what you mean. When you're single, everyone says get on Tinder. Oh, yeah, God. I know.
Look, you know, we live in Wangaratta, for God's sake.
Exactly, yeah, you'll know everyone.
You know everyone.
Yeah. You won't swipe on a guy and then you'll see him down at the
Woolies or something. Yeah, she'll know everyone on there. Oh, God, that's the plumber. Oh, God.
So most people in Wangaratta know absolutely nothing about my life pre-Wangaratta. Why I started this is because I've always said I'm going to write a book when I retire.
Yeah, wonderful. Do you think you will?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. We'll be back next week.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Australian True Crime. The live show is coming.